So again, thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me here. I've been very much looking forward to it, and have in mind some offerings on the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is actually going to be kind of like a sutta study, and I realize I probably was remiss in not preparing a handout for you, but I will bring one next week so you can have a little guide to go along with what I want to talk about. And just by way of introduction, too, because I don't know anybody here except the few people I've met so far, and you don't know me, so it might be nice for you to know that I was talking to Tam before we started, and she was saying how you have teachers from all different traditions coming through, and you know, that can be a real blessing. And just so it can confuse, too, so just so as not to confuse, just to let you know that my leanings are actually my full dedication is to the Thai forest tradition. Some of you may know the great Thai master of the last century, Ajahn Chah, and he established some monasteries in the West for the first time. They've been ordaining Western men and women, first in Thailand, but now there's several monasteries in the Western part of the world, in Europe, and now in America. And, you know, I don't know how these things happen, but each of us sort of has an inclination. You know, you sort of find out how your mind works. And, you know, I used to kind of think that one tradition was right and other traditions were wrong, but, you know, through the years, I've really come to see that it's just not that way. That each one of us has a certain propensity or leaning towards a particular teaching or a couple of teachers or what have you, a tradition. And it probably has to do with just how our minds work and where we hear the Dhamma. And that's the most important thing. So I had the good fortune really early on of hearing the Dhamma from some monks in this tradition who came to IMS when I was sitting there for a period of a couple of years. And you know, just one of those things where it was almost like I picked up at a previous after a previous life or something, you know, where I knew that they, this teaching and the way that they taught and the way they came out, it was for me, you know, it was just, it really resonated. There's just a tremendous amount of open-heartedness and kindness in the way that they practice, and a great emphasis on relationship, living together in harmony, you know, getting along, finding out where our rough spots are, and kind of living together so that we just rub up against each other until we wear them down, you know. So it's kind of like that. And ever since I met them about 20 years ago, I go to the monasteries. The longest time I stayed was about 6 months, but I usually stay 2 or 3 months a year. So over the years, I've spent about 5 or 6 years there altogether. And it's just the cornerstone of my own life and my own practice. So just by way of introduction, so what you're hearing from me is really hardcore Thai forest tradition, which has its roots very much in the early teachings of the Buddha, the Pali Canon, the teachings that were committed to memory and then written down several hundred years later. Okay? So that's where I'll be pulling from. And if anything that I say confuses or startles or anything like that, I hope you'll, you know, just check it out with me and see if there's maybe I haven't said it right, or maybe there's something in the tradition that's slightly different. I don't know. So the reason why we talk about a number of things to teach, and the reason why I wanted to talk about this particular teaching, which is the core teaching of the Buddha on the meditation practice, is for me, for as many years as I've been studying and practicing with this, this particular sutta or teaching just completely astounds me year after year after year. I think it's one of the most brilliant teachings ever offered, not just in the Pali Canon, but ever offered by the Buddha and maybe even by other religious teachers. It's a lot, it's certainly about the meditation practice. It's certainly about it's the how-to. It's, you know, definitely that. But hidden within it is so much of the Dhamma. You know, if we look at it as just a meditation instruction, then we're going to miss the whole thing of what it's leading us toward. You know, one of the big pitfalls, I think, with meditators, at least I've thought myself, I've seen it over and over again with people that I teach and practice with, there can be a tendency to put too much emphasis on the tools of practice and miss the point as to where they're leading, you know, what it's all about. And I think what I've discovered for myself is that understanding what he's saying as he teaches us the meditation practice can really cut through those misperceptions, because if you really get it, that this is a guideline for practice, yes, but what it's about is the end of suffering and how to proceed to that. And what it's also about is examining, like making a laboratory out of this very body and mind that we think we are, and discerning for ourselves what it's all about. I mean, this is home. You know, we all got born into this, and this is the way it's been since the day we were born. But what's it about? You know, what goes on in the body and the mind, and how are we relating to it? And I think that you'll see as we examine the instruction that he's offering here is that in many ways we're relating to it in ways that are actually creating the suffering. And what he's endeavoring to do in this teaching is turn that on its head, you know, just to offer a whole new way of looking at our experience with much more detachment, much more understanding, so that the things that are currently our experience of suffering can be seen more clearly. You know, and what I love about it too, it is so much a can-do kind of thing. You know, there's nothing in his teaching that has any kind of elitist overtones to it. Only you know, a privileged few can do this or understand it. You know, it is so available to us all. It's just all a matter of understanding what he's saying and how to follow the instructions and seeing for ourselves where they lead. And that process then just keeps feeding itself, and you know, you keep getting better and better and happier through the years. At least that's been my experience. And so I do want to walk us through it. We have four sessions together, and there's four sections in the sutra. It's not likely that I'll get through the first one tonight because it's the meatiest. It's about attachment to the body, and we tend to be pretty locked in there. But we'll just kind of get through. We'll go through what we can in each night and see how far we can get. And I expect we can get through it all in the four sessions. And if not, I'll tag some onto the half days and the one days that we have together. So just by way of framing it, I want to back up a little bit and look at these two things that I'm sure most of you in the room are quite familiar with, the two aspects of meditation practice, the concentration and the mindfulness, or what we call the formal practice of samatha and vipassana. And just to see if we're all on the same page about what these two are. You know, we talk about samatha, which is, or samadhi, maybe some of you refer to it that way. And this is a practice or a approach to the mind that engenders an effort to bring about some tranquility, bring some calm, not only into the mind, but into the body as well. So that, you know, we call it tranquility, we call it ease, we call it you know, calming the mind, settling the mind, these kinds of things. And it's a very important aspect of practice, because you know, you don't have to meditate very long to see that in the sort of raw state, the unawakened state, the mind is just all over the place. I mean, it's here, it's there, it's, you know, I don't know, even sometimes I've sat and I'm having these conversations in my head. It's like there's not just two or three people in there, there's like all kinds, you know. It's just all the concerns and worries about the world, and then battles and opinions going back and forth inside our head. And without some semblance of calm or tranquility in the mind, we're completely at the mercy of this stuff. You know, you just, whatever these voices are saying, you know, we're just believing it, following it, lost in the conversations, or following their bidding, you know, up out of the chair and doing what they're telling us to do. You know, the Tibetans have an expression for this. They actually say that if you can see this, if you can see that this is the way the mind is, then you actually, you know, this is the first great insight of insight meditation. You're actually in good shape, so it's not something to feel bad about, you know, if you can see this. And they call it seeing the mind as a waterfall. It's just like gushing, just all this stuff coming up, relentlessly, you know, and seemingly we have no control over it. And in the unharnessed and unawakened state, that's very, very true. You know, one of the monks said one time, you know, without meditation, it's 100% compulsion. You know, life is 100% compulsion. We're just riding the waves of past karma, past habits and patterns that we've set up, and that includes thinking, the habit of thinking thoughts that come into the mind, and, you know, feeling things that we feel, and being preoccupied with the body, all of that. So samatha is an approach that sets about the training of the mind so that there's some semblance of primarily relaxation and ease in it, but also it tends to get a little more focused. You know, it tends to get a little more chilled out, you know, so that what we do, the main mechanism for this is coming back to the breath every time you feel that you've lost. You lost your awareness, you come back to the breath, or come back to the body, come back to sensation. We use the breath, but it doesn't have to be only the breath. So, you know, this coming back is the training. You know, and one of the things that is often confused, and I know I did this, you know, people get the idea that this practice is about establishing and sustaining uninterrupted attention on the breath. And it's not. You know, and if you think that's what it is, then you can spend years in meditation trying to get good at watching the breath. You know, and it's crazy. So why would you want to do that? You know, it's not. It's an understanding that samatha is a calming, that it's an effort to, it's much more about when you're off, coming back. It's like, oh, caught in the scramble again, come back. Oh, caught in the scramble again, come back. Caught in the scramble again, come back. And the Buddha used this wonderful image to describe it. You know, he talked about these six animals that are tied together, and each one representing one of the six senses, you know, mm-hmm. seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. And they're tied together, but they're not anchored in any way. So whichever one is the strongest is where they're all going to go. So like if the hearing is the strongest, then you're going to, what was that? You know, if the thoughts were the strongest, then you've lost the thoughts. You know, if the sensations in the body were the strongest, then you're going to go there. And that's a very apt picture, I think, of what's going on in the unharnessed, untamed mind. So he said, all you want to do then is just want to anchor that, and that begins the process of training. Yeah. So like they might be tied together, but they're anchored to the ground, and then every time they run off, they have to come back because they can only go as far as the rope will allow them to go. So you know, this is what we're doing with samatha, trying to sustain some semblance of actually establishing ourselves in the present moment and staying here. It's like, what a revolutionary idea. not our common experience, is it? No. So this is very important. And if that's all you do, If you spend your formal meditation practice that way, all the time, just trying to come back, remembering to come back and coming back, then your time will be very well spent. And I think actually it has to be said that for those of us living in this Western culture, which is extremely stimulating, if you spend an hour a day just trying to keep the mind in one place, instead of going off to this billboard and that sign and this sound and this sort of, then that really serves well, and that's a good way to spend your time. Now, having said that, there's a lot more to it, and fortunately, meditation is a 24/7 kind of thing, so I'm not only talking about what we do on the cushion. If you spend your time on the cushion like that, that's great. We can also do some more than that, because the limitations of that kind of practice are such that you can end up with an idea that you have to establish and sustain some certain condition in order to find any kind of happiness. In order to be happy in the world, that you somehow have to be very, very still. And I see this a lot with people who practice informal retreats, where they get very addicted to the stillness that samatha brings, and then they don't realize that they're actually perpetuating, like establishing conditions that you just can't sustain in daily life. You can't keep that up. If you've ever been on retreat, and then when you leave your retreat, you sort of whimper, you go back into it, then you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. And there can be a slight distortion if that whimper is there, because we're actually sort of, I understand it on one hand. It's like, yeah, this is great stuff. We get so quiet and still. But we really aren't trying to sustain that in daily life. We just need enough of that to be able to see what's going on. And Ajahn Chah was once asked, how much samatha do you need? And he said, just enough to establish some presence of mind. Just enough to actually sort of be here a little bit more, so that you can see what's going on. And this is where the vipassana comes in, the insight practice. The vipassana is about seeing into things, noticing what's happening, being able to understand through direct observation, through direct knowledge, the nature of the mind. And it's enormously enhanced by our capacity to relax. If we don't have that, then we're not going to be able to see much. So these two are very important. And just two points I want to make before I get into the sutta about them. The first is one that Ajahn Chah would drive this home over and over and over again in his teachings. He would say, for the purposes of understanding, for the purposes of wisdom, for the purposes of liberation, do not separate these two in your mind. Do not think of, now I have my concentration practices and now I have my insight practices. That they, for the purposes of insight, they are the same. And we need to realize this, that you can't have one without the other. It won't work. That the calming, the concentrating, the tranquilizing is a baseline for seeing. You can't see clearly if you don't have that. And as we see, then the concentration actually changes. It gets deeper and deeper, and it's not dependent upon external conditions or special mannerisms or ways of being. And the reason is that because as we come to see the nature of phenomena, the nature of the body and mind, then we begin to see into the way that we're relating to them. And you can see the very craving, the core of our suffering and the ignorance that keeps driving the craving, that keeps driving the grabbing hold of things. And once you see that, then, or as you see this, and this is over a period of years and perhaps lifetimes, then what happens is that you're actually establishing a basis for letting go. Yeah. How are you gonna let go if you don't even know why you're letting go? You don't even know the nature of the phenomenon that we keep picking up. Yeah. So the Vipassana helps us see that, and it forms the basis of insight. So we come to understand the changing nature of it all. We come to understand how not seeing that is our suffering. We come to understand how we're trying to control and manage and direct the whole show, and that is a tremendous amount of our difficulty. And as you have insight into impermanence, suffering, and non-self, and you can feel this, and then, you know, the letting go is a piece of cake. You know, it's like, why pick it up? It's all my suffering that I'm letting go of. Yeah. So don't sacrifice them. And there's one more thing, is to consider, just to look and examine in your mind and heart how you are conceiving these two, mindfulness and concentration. And really give this a hefty examination, because we get a lot of crazy ideas about what these are. Yeah, and I would say, if there's anything that I could offer that would be the most beneficial to you in your upcoming practice, it would be this. It's just dare to have no idea whatsoever what tranquility and awareness, mindfulness and concentration are. Dare not to know. And instead, look in this moment's experience repeatedly to try to discover for yourself what it is we're even talking about. You know, it's actually said that these qualities are very rare. And yet, I certainly did this, and I suspect that some of you have too. When I heard that meditation instruction on the first day of my first meditation retreat, and they said, relax, and pay attention, be mindful, concentrate and be mindful. I picked that up like, yes, sir. From that point on, decided I knew what I was doing and tried to do it. Yeah? And that took about 10 years to undo. Because it's just not like that, you know. It's like the Buddha even emphasizes this a lot in his teaching, that if you conceive something, if you identify with your notion about what something is, then you have just removed yourself from the experience of it. You'll never know something that you are trying to become. If you're trying to become mindful, we're trying to become concentrated, we've actually just set ourselves up outside of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how self-view is formed. And then we spend our lives trying to be that way. And so, you know, you've got to deconstruct that whole construction to even get started in a way, you know. And it's not a bad thing. You know, we don't want to be, you know, taking out the whip and going on about it. I think it's really coming from the fact that we are so channeled through a sense of self that you have to know that you're going to do this with the meditation practice. You have to know that we're going to, you know, think that we're on top of it, you know. and just like break that down, and you know, and just try to find out in the moment, right here, right now, you know. What is the experience of being relaxed? It's like, I know it's in here somewhere, you know. And just try to find it and settle into it. And become more and more familiar with it. Like, make the meditation practice an effort to become familiar with the terrain of tranquility. What is it? What's it like? And then as you get more and more relaxed and comfortable with that, then noticing how in that state, and only in that state, are you able to see what's happening. And what's that? That bit that knows what's happening. Isn't it the wildest thing? It's like, as far as we know, it's uniquely human. There's a bit in us that is aware, knows what's happening in the body, and knows what's happening in the mind. And what the Buddha brilliantly does in his teaching is engage that, or just in a way, untangle it from the habit of self-absorption, so that it can be used. What I mean by that is that this awareness of what's going on is almost entirely preoccupied with what's going on with me and what's happening to me and how. And what I can do about it, you know. It's just like this relentless self-absorption. And that has to get freed up. And this is what his teaching on non-self is all about. It's like, free that up. It's an unbelievable capacity that we have as human beings. And we just don't know how to use it. we're too preoccupied with ourselves. So, but that is the very mechanism, that capacity to look at ourselves, to know what's happening, is the mechanism for insight and liberation. But it's not about me. It's about the Dhamma, and we have to direct it in that way. So this Satipatthana Sutta does that. This is what it's about. So let me just see if you have some questions so far, and I want to get into this a little bit tonight. Any thoughts or questions or reflections, comments? Yeah.
What do you mean when you say Dhamma? You say it's not about me, it's about Dhamma. What is that?
When we talk about the Dhamma, it usually means two things. Classically, the Dhamma is the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings that are found in the Pali Canon. In a more transcendent sense, it has to do with seeing the nature of all phenomena that are mental and physical. So the Dhamma in this sense is impermanent suffering and non-self. Sometimes it's talked about as seeing the truth of the lost karma and seeing the Four Noble Truths. And we talk about it as panya, or wisdom, the wisdom part of the Eightfold Path. Are you familiar with that? The Eightfold Path? Yeah. Well, it's broken up, the eight steps are broken up into three, and panya, wisdom, is right view and right understanding and right intention. So it's an understanding of things as they are. And that's the Dhamma. Yeah? Okay. I think I better get my glass. So we go to the catering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this this sutta is, have some of you studied this before? I bet a lot of you have, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. Okay. So you're not unfamiliar with it. It's called the Satipatthana Sutta, the Foundations of Mindfulness. And just at the get-go, it's helpful to consider that this this translation of even the title of it is worth reflecting on, because it's usually translated as the Foundations of Mindfulness, and this is sati and patana, sati being mindfulness and patana having to do with a foundation or a root or something like that. But it also could be a translation of a different combination of words, which would mean the establishing of mindfulness. And I actually like that one better, because in a way, when you talk about self-foundations of mindfulness, you get into this whole thing with nouns. And this mind loves nouns. You know? It's not so good with verbs. And meditation is very much a verb-oriented practice, you know. So it's about establishing awareness of different parts of the body and the mind, yeah. So that's it's a better way to hold it, I think. So let me just say what he says about this. This is a teaching. Basically, every sutta, they kind of set it up. They talk about where it took place and who was there. But then he says this. He says, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana, namely these four establishments of mindfulness, establishing of mindfulness. Surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, the disappearance of pain and grief, the attainment of the true way, the realization of nirvana. I don't know about you, when I read that, it was like, whoa! It just really gets your attention. You know, this is the direct path for our freedom from all difficulties, for the realization of the unconditioned, the movement beyond what we know as our worldly way of existence and transcending. I think of it too as, just to keep it in the human realm, I think of it as like a training or a practice, if you will, that is designed to help us all optimize this experience of being a human being. You know, we're really kind of caught up in a lot of the animal impulses still. I think it's a whole evolutionary thing, you know. We haven't quite fully evolved into being optimally human. We've got all the makings of it, but the conditions that are possible, the states that are possible for human beings. You know, the Buddha talks about these as these wonderful states. I mean, you talked about generosity. I mean, you know, that generosity is like, man, it doesn't get much better than that. The feeling of extending instead of grabbing and pulling towards, you know, the feeling of concern for the welfare of other people instead of want, you know, just that whole turning around. You know, he talks about the heavenly states, the divine abodes, the states of mind that are possible as standards for human beings, you know, but we're kind of like teenagers, or I don't know, maybe younger than that, in terms of realizing what's possible for us. Yes, there's a bit of transcending of self that has to take place for this movement to occur, and this is what this is about: the direct path for the, because all of the suffering that we know is in these other self-absorbed states. And all of the places that are possible for us are in these transcendent states. So nirvana, I mean, you can think about nirvana as some lofty, you know, otherworldly condition. But, and maybe that's true, I don't know. But I think it's a lot more about realization of these states, a very skillful and happy concern for the welfare of other people. And the reason why I say that is that the definition of people who have become free, what we call somebody who has become free, is an arahant. And what they say about an arahant is this is someone who operates functionally in terms of themselves. They do what needs to be done. They're very good stewards for themselves, caring for themselves. But also completely, other than that, completely for the welfare of other people. And that's possible for us. And I don't know about you, I'm getting goosebumps. I mean, when I think about that, that's got to be a happy way to be. I mean, there's no two ways about it. You know, we all know it. We all get glimpses of it, don't we? We have little mini nirvanas day in and day out. Especially for a parent, you know, your care and concern for people in our lives. So this is a way to kind of free up a lot of tendencies that are standing in the way of these optimal states. And not to mention, you know, the grief that goes along with being caught in them. So the key phraseology here, which we're going to hear throughout the teaching, merits some attention right at the get-go. He says, what are the four things that we want to contemplate? He said, one abides contemplating a body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and greed for the world. So that's the first foundation, contemplating a body as a body. And then he uses the same language, contemplating feelings as feelings. Contemplating the mind as the mind, and contemplating mind objects as mind objects. That one is going to develop a new way of being, essentially, is what he's saying. To be in the body as the body. Not as how I feel about it, what I think about it, what I wish it would look like, the way that it was yesterday, how it could be, the shoulda, coulda, wouldas about the body, you know? But actually, you know, when it was young, you know? But actually, like developing a capacity to be with the body as it is, however it is. Sick, healthy, old, young, whatever, right? Fat, skinny, all of it. Being with the body as a body, being with feelings as feelings, being that with the experience of pleasure, pain, and neither, as just that much. And now it hurts. Now it feels great. Now it doesn't feel like much of anything. You know, to be able to be with life in this way, to be with the mind as the mind, to know an angry mind as an angry mind. A mind that is not angry is a mind that is not angry. And so we'll get into this more, but just to to know what one knows about the Dhamma, that's the fourth one, to understand. So this language is very important. He's setting up, in the very beginning of the instruction, a way of being that is decidedly different than what we usually experience. I mean, just looking at the body, for example. I mean, a simple thing like eating. You know, I don't know about you, but it's like, oh man, all hell breaks loose when it's mealtime, you know, inside the mind. Because it's like, especially, you know, if you ever notice if you're on the streets and somebody has offered the food and it's this beautiful spread. And you may, you know, walk into the dining hall fully aware that you're not very hungry. But, you know, then you come out the end of the line with a, you know, a plate full of food that, you know, no three people could eat, you know. It's like, how'd that happen? What happened? But this is, we weren't with the body as the body. You know, this is what it got a little more complicated. Ajahn Sumedho says, ignorance complicates everything. And that's because we got lost in the way that it looked, mm-hmm. or the way that it smelled, and how we felt about it, and the thoughts that we had about it, and this became our world. You know, all the ideas and the notions and the reality of what is got lost in the shuffle. But the experience of the mind, what the mind did with it, became the world, and that's where we live. And so then, you know, you end up with this crazy thing, you know. Well, I mean, you see all kinds of examples like this, and especially with the body, where, like, you know, another common one is just that, have you ever noticed how maybe you might find yourself in a mood and not really knowing how the mood got there? But if you look, I mean, maybe you're a little bound up in the gut, or maybe the seasons were changing and, you know, you're a little, maybe you got a little allergic thing going on. And I know, not seeing this one time myself, I found myself very sad and kind of depressed and wondering, what happened? How did I get this way? And then I looked and I saw, and really it was just the pressure around my eyes, you know, that feeling of about to cry. And actually there wasn't any kind of mental state, it was a physical state, but I couldn't see it. Yeah? So this, what he attempts to do through this sutra is begin the process of, in a way, giving back to the body what belongs to the body. Giving back to feeling pleasure, pain, and neither what belongs there. Putting in the mind category what belongs in the mind. And not entangling all of these. This is, you know, it seems so obvious, but this is not our experience. You know, this is all a tangled web, a tangled net. He actually used the image of a web, like a ball of yarn and things like this to describe the state that we find ourselves in. It's all a big muddle and tangled up. So we want to use it, the teaching and the practices, to begin to untangle all of that. And he starts with the body. I'm just going to take a few minutes and do a little bit of the body, the breath part. And this is interesting because the sutra starts with the breath training. But it's very interesting, I think, in that a lot of us never get past it. And I think it's a phenomenon of really getting a lot of our meditation instruction on retreats. And so often a retreat for a day or two or even several days, and the breath meditation tends to predominate because that's generally where you start. But really, as you'll see as we walk through this, the Buddha puts forth this thing, this field of awareness that starts very narrow but keeps expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding. In our retreat, we don't often get to the bits beyond the breath. But this is like a 10 or 12 or 14 page sutra. Yeah, 10 pages, 10, 11 pages. And the breath meditation is only not even half a page. There's a lot more to it than that. But here's what he says. How does one abide contemplating a body as a body? Gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or an empty hut, one sits down and, having folded the legs crosswise and set the body erect, establish mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, one breathes in. Ever mindful, one breathes out. Breathing in long, one understands I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one understands I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one understands I breathe in short. Breathing out short, one understands I breathe out short. One trains thus. I breathe in, experiencing the whole body. I breathe out, experiencing the whole body. One trains thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formation. One trains thus, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the bodily formation. So this is essentially a description, I think, of what happens in the, in your period of formal meditation. You sit, you find, whether you go to the forest or the root of a tree, you can take that literally or symbolically. He does recommend meditating in the forest. But symbolically, it just means put everything aside. Get away. You know, have your little niche, your little place where you go to meditate, and go there. And do what you need to do to be comfortable enough to sit there for 45 minutes or an hour. And support your own effort to be relaxed and aware. Just set that all up. Establish that all. And when you do that, then lo and behold, what will you notice? You know, the first thing that becomes very apparent is that you're breathing. And that's the only reason why he brings in the breath. You know, it's just when you get settled, there it is. It's like it comes to you, you know. So you'll notice the way that it is. Sometimes it's long, sometimes it's short. It doesn't matter. Don't get hung up with how it is. One of the monks says that actually when he's talking about this long and short, he's actually describing a process where initially, as you're first settling, you kind of ride the breath. You know, you're kind of right there with it. So that's what he's calling the long breath. Either. Right? You're kind of like a surfer on the wave of it. But as you get more and more settled, then it's almost like the breath just kind of rises in front of you. It's not so much that you're that close to it, that you're riding it, but it's something that's in the field of your awareness. And this is actually an indication that you're getting more settled. You know, when you're not so close, you're not right up on top of it. But, I actually sometimes even experience I'm sitting back further on my cushion or chair. Yeah? You're getting more relaxed. And there it is. And then what proceeds from that is that there's a tranquilizing of the whole body. You know, the mind starts to expand, the awareness starts to expand to where it's not just the breath. You're actually feeling the relaxation much more energetically throughout the whole body, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Yeah? And one can actually, before that, there's experiencing the whole body. So you get a sense of this lump of protoplasm sitting here. And then back even further, the whole thing is calmer and more still. So this is like foundational. This is how you start. And as I said, if this is all you're doing in your meditation practice, great. It's going great. But he's actually setting this up for a whole lot more, which we'll begin to get into next week. So let me just stop there and see if you have some thoughts or questions or comments about that moment. Yeah.
Can you say a little more about how, say, coming back to the breath is much more of a practice than getting on the breath?
I think it's more about... that's not entirely what I said. It's not that it's more of a practice than staying on the breath. It's that the wandering off is a given. Okay? And if we think it's about staying on the breath, then that wandering off is almost always accompanied by a... Yeah? So you get this exasperation in practice and frustration. So what I mean to say is just to offset that by recognizing that it's not about getting, you may in fact get here and stay here, but if you make it that, then it just becomes exercises and failures. Yeah. So have it be a given that it doesn't do that. And then this bit that becomes aware and turns and settles back with absolute kindness in your heart, not that, you know, that is a lot more, that is what we're going for. That the value is placed highly on the capacity to recognize when you're not here, be kind to yourself, and reestablish yourself in here. That's all I mean. I hope I didn't confuse.
This is something that I was thinking about too, so I'm glad you brought that up. That it seems to me that in going off into daydreaming or whatever, there's no awareness at all there. It's just daydreaming. And when the daydream stops, in that same instant of the daydream stopping is the awareness that there was daydreaming.
Yeah.
That moment is already present.
Yes.
There's no need to then think, I need to get somewhere.
Yes.
It's already present.
Yes.
But there is, I would say, an interest to stay. But it doesn't have to be tied to, now I should focus on something, or I should have done something. You can't. And the daydreaming is just daydreaming.
Yeah.
But a moment, a tiny moment, where there's presence, and the daydreaming may stop immediately again with, I should have done this, I should have done that, I need to focus on my breath, I need to bear down with other habits that we develop that we think we need to do, not realizing that it was just that moment, it's just presence. Is it possible to stay with that? Because the alternative, we know the alternative. The alternative is just craziness.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're pointing to really one of the main definitions of sati, which is often translated as mindfulness. It's something that just got established a long time ago. But even Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's one of the chief Pali scholars of our time, says that that's not actually an accurate translation. That sati has to do with remembering, you know, and that moment when you've been all over the place, and something happens, either because you've got bored with what you've been going off with, or because it's a fruit of past mindfulness. It reestablishes itself. It comes forth out of that chaos, and there is the remembering.
And nobody does it.
Yes.
It's just, it's a moment where there isn't somebody doing everything.
Yeah.
That's all. And then the mind builds it again very, very, very quickly.
Yes.
And then maybe later another moment.
Yes.
It does. It doesn't come from an activity. It doesn't come from practicing anything.
Right. It comes from awareness, and one even has to be aware of those moments. And what I like to do in those moments, when instead of getting annoyed or irritated that I've been off, but actually, that is actually just kind of soak in the good feeling of being back, because the direct experience of what it feels like to be here is the primary conditioner of mindfulness. That is what will make it reappear. Yeah.
So I'm coming to practice doing yoga. So I'm trying to reconcile some terms.
Yes, yes.
So you talked about now I'm back, and so I spent a little time trying to detach from this I, who is the back, who is the observer, what being observed. So I mean, is there this notion of what yoga is, that it's not you, that is not the mind nor the body, and is that what's back? Is it sort of taking the attention off the monkey of the mind and allowing that sort of not you to be and to observe?
Is that similar?
No,
exactly.
Or,
that sounds good. That sounds right. Well, no, the language fails. I mean, even the Buddha talked about himself, and me and my life and, you know, my experiences and stuff, that you have to use this language to talk about it. So, but you're right. I mean, the I am back is actually the direct experience of presence of mind. Yeah. So you got it. A plus. Yeah.
I was thinking about your point about being generous and so forth, and I was raised in, you know, Christian background and everything, where, you know, there's a lot of, at least the way I interpreted the teachings, that, you know, you have to be a good person and you have to give to everybody and, you know, whatever. And for me personally, that sort of took on, like, sort of sacrificing myself for other people. And so when I think about generosity, I can see how, like, theoretically, it would give you a lot of joy, but it's very hard for me because it feels like there's not enough here to give. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just kind of, you know, this comes from my ignorance of Buddhism, but where do you develop the inner, whatever, strength or, I guess there is strength to sort of feel like you have enough to give and it's not taking away from you. Because it feels like I give, but I don't get it back a lot of the time.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I mean, that may be the case. I don't know, you know. So the key, I think, is observing what's going on with you in each moment. And use that as a guide. And lose the ideas about what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But actually pay attention to the direct experience. You know, the Buddha is just really big on direct knowledge. And if you consider the whole training as a process, then, you know, you're not trying to get here. You're not trying to win the prize or be the one who is ultimately generous. What you're trying to do is see, what does it feel like to be contracted around giving? What does it feel like not to be contracted around it? What's all the entanglement that's going on around the creation of that contraction and the extension? And just play with it. So, you know, to get from like the kind of thing that you're describing to, you know, experience is just that freer movement within it is a whole process. Yeah, and trust that. I mean, you're right in there with it. You're doing great. Just even asking these kinds of questions. You know, you are on the path of understanding generosity. You know, lose the notion of arriving. Yeah. Yes, one more, and then we'll stop.
I wanted to speak to that, ma'am. I have a friend that's been having a great many problems, and I haven't been able to do anything to help her. And something came up today where I could help her. And she was so grateful, and I said, wait a minute, because she kept going on and on and on about how, you know. And I said, let me explain something to you. Because at that time when I did that, I was so full of joy. And I said, you know, we practice generosity as a practice. And if you don't let me do this, then I don't get to practice the generosity. But I really, truly, the joy that I felt in being able to help this woman, once you've tasted it, it really feels wonderful. There's no greed in that moment. There's just this wonderful open feeling of having done something to help somebody.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that out for you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. That's great. So as a practice with all of these good things, keeping the precepts, you know, one of the things that we can miss about the precepts, you know, the five precepts, which includes not taking things that aren't given, which is the flip side of generosity. You know, they really are all about seeing when you are behaving that way and when you are not. You know, it's not framed in this sense of trying to become something that we're not. It's all framed in the sense of one has to discover for oneself the truth of actions and consequences. And that's a probably a multi-lifetime process. Yeah. So just to be at peace with it. Yeah. So we've covered a lot, and I just want to thank you all for coming tonight. I think we might have, do we have some announcements?
Some announcements.
Sorry, we went a few minutes over. I apologize for that, and we'll pick it up where we left off.